time for another edition of Blind Like Me. It's Phil Parr and Stephen Guerra. We've been talking to this guy a long time, or visiting with this, knowing this man a long time, but never talked to him. And how are you, sir?
Good. Good. It's a beautiful, muggy, warm day here in New York on October 6th and, or 7th, whatever it is. And
7th,
yeah, October 7th. It's hard to believe it's that warm in October.
Is that where you are? Is in New York City?
I'm about 15 miles east on Long Island in a town called Freeport. It's the last stop before Jones Beach. If anyone's ever been to New York, Jones Beach is a world-renowned beach. It's big. It's beautiful. It's expansive. It has everything anybody could ever want in a beach. It has multiple parking fields for people to go into different parts of the water, whether it be a bay or waves or whatever you want. And they have so much to offer, but it's the closest spot to that Jones Beach, and it's about 15 miles east of New York City.
All right. Do people sunbathe or swim there or fish there, or what do they do at that beach?
They do everything. They sunbathe, they swim, they fish, they play miniature golf, they play shuffleboard, they walk on the five-mile-long boardwalk. There's restaurants there. There's an amphitheater where you can take in some great concerts. And Lord knows I've been there many times. And I'm surprised. What are the other people that you've had on Blind Like Me show with you, and is also very frequent in responding on the email list? I'm sure Dan Rossi has probably been to the amphitheater for a concert or two.
I would imagine he has. Now, Dan lives in Pittsburgh, of course, so you know.
I know. He moved there. He abandoned Long Island. But I know Danny since he's 13 years old, and I'm about 5 years younger than he is. Uh-huh. But I'm not going to tell you how old I am. See,
well, no. I could figure because I know about how old Danny is.
I'm 38. I just turned 38 in April. I'll be 39 in this upcoming April.
I've never called him Danny before. I guess maybe I don't know him that well. Reckon I don't know.
Well, it's just another couple consonants on top of Dan.
Well, we're going, as a matter of fact, in a couple of weeks, we're going to end up in Pittsburgh and have an eye to eye or face to face visit with your friend Danny.
There you go.
We're going. He's built a new deck, and we're going to get him to show it to us. He's quite often a guest on our blind handyman show, and
I've listened to that too. It's good listening. You do good work, Phil.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Now, your blindness stems from what, and what is your level of vision? Tell us about yourself a little.
I was born with congenital cataracts back in 1969, and I went to have those actually removed surgically, and because of complications of the surgery, I lost my eyesight because of an infection. So I am totally blind, completely blind. Now, I also have a twin by the name of Frank who lives outside of Des Moines, Iowa, in a town called Waukee, Iowa, who had the same situation I had. But when we were about three, we had a medication applied to our eyes, which essentially would have deteriorated the cataracts into air bubbles. So essentially the process of removing the cataracts then in 1974 would have been just taking the air bubbles off of the eyes. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. So in both my eyes and one of Frank's eyes, who's my twin, we developed an infection as a result of the surgery. So therefore, we lost the sight in those eyes. Now, my brother can see with corrective vision out of his – it's been a long time, and it's not like I can look at him and tell you.
Yeah.
I think it's his right eye he can see out of. His left eye is where he's blind. I could be wrong, and I could have that all mixed up. But at least my best recollection, that's how it is.
Maybe we'll call him and ask him, can he see well enough to use that, in other words, to drive or to read or anything out of that one eye?
He can see well enough to read and to be a normal part of society. Uh-huh. He cannot drive. He is considered legally blind. He is considered a blind athlete because he does play beat baseball with me on our team, the team here in New York called the Long Island Bombers. Mm-hmm. So he is, according to the United States Association for Blind Athletes, when we competed with them, a B1, which is a high-level partial.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we'd want to interview him sometime. Maybe we'd like to have him on the show also.
That's a possibility. That would be good. Surely put him in contact with you.
Do that. And you were born this way, or not really born this way, this happened later. When they time to send you to school, did they send you to Batavia, or what did they do with you?
We at the kindergarten age, I was excluded from kindergarten because then, back in 1974, the idea or the theory of sending a child who's totally blind to a mainstream school was almost completely unheard of. So the situation being is I didn't go to kindergarten. My brother Frank did. But we were enrolled in the day camp for the blind, which was ran by Industrial Home for the Blind, which is now Helen Keller Services of Brooklyn, New York, Hempstead, New York, which is on Long Island, and also Huntington, New York, which is also on Long Island. And they ran a day camp out of SUNY, which is State University in New York, Farmingdale campus, for children who were blind or low vision in the Long Island, on the Long Island area, or in the Long Island area.
Yeah.
So we went to a day camp, and there was a woman that ran the day camp. She was a social worker by the name of Myra Berzoff, who I attribute a lot of my adventuresome part of my personality to her, because she didn't feel that a child should be restricted from doing what they want to do, and they should always be given a chance in doing something once so they have the taste of what it's like.
Yeah.
So she had a conversation with my mother and father, who, of course, at that point, they're new parents to two boys who are visually impaired, and of course they're terrified. They don't know what to expect. They don't know if the right thing to do is to send us to a school for the blind. And at that point, it was either Batavia or Lavelle School for the Blind in the Bronx, or the New York Institute for Special Education in the Bronx. But she said, no, no. She says, you really need to mainstream them. They really need to be mainstreamed, because they have personalities, dynamic personalities, that they will be able to succeed in a mainstream setting.
Yeah.
So with that, we were enrolled into public school here in Freeport. We went to Archer Street Elementary School with my principal then was a Mr. Haley, and with his willingness and his patience, with my mother's patience and the everyone involved, including teachers for the visually impaired, which that's what they're called now, but then they were called itinerant teachers. We were able then to go through the grades with other students being mainstreamed in a regular setting, minus any hardships.
All right, let's don't get away from this blind camp just yet. What did they teach you there at blind camp that you said this lady was, you think, instrumental in your adventuresomeness or your personality developing? What sort of things did she try to encourage you to do?
Well, they allowed us the opportunity to participate in sports, you know, and to interact with other children who are visually impaired, and to socially learn how to cope not only with individuals who are like us, but to what's acceptable and what's proper, meaning right and wrong things to do. That your parents wouldn't let you do that, wouldn't let you run through the lobby of this building, so neither am I. We also had activities such as swimming in the Olympic-sized pool.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you a funny story. Is later on in years, when I was a baby, maybe about 9 or 10 years old, I have a dear friend who is the executive director for the Office for People with Disabilities of the City of New York. He works directly for Michael Bloomberg.
Uh-huh.
His name is Matthew Saplin. Well, he and I grew up together. He's about a year younger than I am. So we met each other at this day camp, and we hit it off. We still are the best of friends. And when we were about 10 years old, we would give both of our mothers heart attacks, because we would go up onto a high dive board, which was about 3 meters off the water. Matt would sit on the end of the diving board, or he would stand at the end of the diving board, and I would stand back where the rails ended, and I would spring him off. So imagine two blind kids doing this to each other back and forth, running up and down, going up and down a 10-foot diving board into 15 feet of water. Now, in today's standards, for insurance reasons, that would never be allowed. But then it was an opportunity that, look, they're not getting hurt. If one of us were to have gotten hurt, it would have stopped. However, we were having fun, and we were experiencing what we needed to experience as children. We were allowed, despite the fact that we couldn't see, to be children and to be mischievous and be all that and do everything a child should be able to do.
I've been around enough blind people that I can imagine that, but for sighted people, that would be a terror almost. That would just be.
It gave my mother, gave both of our mothers heart attacks. It was fun just the same, but also, again, Myra Birdsoff allowed all the campers, not just Matthew and I and my brother Frank, all the campers to experience what it is to climb trees if we wanted to climb trees. Participate in activities on all different levels. We had sports days that it was almost like a carnival or an Olympics type of thing for the of all different things for blind people, track and field. And if I remember right, in 1979, and this gentleman just passed away, Al Order, world class discus thrower. What? He came out to our camp. And he participated in our sports day, and just a lovely, lovely man to meet. And he certainly was part of that. That was back in 1979. What a great time! The camp really allowed us to not only interact with our own kind, if you will, but also just to do everything that we could have done. And we all were enriched and grew because of that. Because we reflect back on that.
What age were you when all this took place?
I started in the camp in 1975, and I went there through 1981. And then we all at some point evolved, and there was a sleepaway camp in a place that you're kind of familiar with in Vermont, in a town called outside of a town called Hardwick. It was called Wapanaki Sleepaway Camp for the Blind. And kids from all over the area of New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, and the New England states all had the chance to, of course, for a fee, go and spend 2 weeks in a sleepaway camp that they were there and away from their parents. And they needed to – it was the next level of growing up. Is that if you were you had to learn how to be responsible for yourself and taking care of your laundry and doing chores in the cabin because you lived in log cabins with other people, and you learned how to get along with other people that maybe you didn't know, and you know, and of course you developed even more friends. I mean, I met a gentleman that he's a teacher here in Long Island in Farmingdale. His name is James Hughes, very dear friend. He's the captain of the Long Island Bombers, and again, a long-term friend. So now you're looking back with Matt Saplin and James Hughes. You're looking at friendships, and these gentlemen are also blind for 20, 25 years.
Yeah,
and it's long-lasting friendships, just like with Danny Rossi. Yeah.
Now, was Danny Rossi there at these camps? Did he go?
He went to the day camp. And I also took part in the Industrial Home for the Blind. Again, like I said, now it's called Helen Keller Services, ran a Saturday program. And Dan Rossi and I, amongst other people, went to the Saturday program because it was teaching us living skills.
Yeah.
How to cook, how to do laundry. I don't believe ironing was part of that, but how to manage money, how to go to a mall and shopping and such like that, and how to go and buy something in a store, and things that maybe we had never been exposed to before, or if we were, how to make ourselves more aesthetically pleasing so we're not looked at as space cadets.
Well, so you don't do blindisms. You don't flip your hands.
What's more sociably acceptable?
Yeah, you have to be. It is, you know, we discuss endlessly here. It is a sighted world, and it is up to you to be part of that and not them to be, not the other way around. Well, I consider Danny Rossi, or Dan Rossi, one of the best adjusted blind people I've ever known. And so this camp must have done some good for the both of you.
It did, and the camp is still in existence now. I can tell you there's a lot more restrictions now. You don't have the opportunity to climb trees and do all that, and I think they took the diving boards away out of the pool. But, you know, look, the camp started, I believe, back in the early 1970s. So, I mean, it was, you know, it's a changing time. You look back in 1975, Phil, to what it is now.
Oh, yeah.
The whole world has changed.
The world is a different place now, sir. Now, but it's your education, you went to a public school just like other sighted children.
Correct. I went mainstreamed all the way through first through 12th grade.
Did you have some sighted friends, or were all your friends blind, or what?
All my friends were sighted. The only time I actually interacted with other children people who were blind or low vision is when I went to the camp. Well, uh-huh. we had a Christmas party for the people from the camp. But you know, that was my interaction. All my other interaction with sighted kids.
Uh-huh.
So I mean, I grew up all through that. But I mean, like you just said before, it's a sighted world. We have to acclimate to that.
Now, your brother was with you during all this time. I guess there was probably some healthy competition between you and your brother to be able to do things, or was there?
Of course, in the fact that we're twins, there's always going to be even more competition. But nevertheless, and I want to go off on a tangent and tell you this real quick.
Okay.
Even in competition today, when Frank and I compete against other teams and we're on the same team playing beat baseball, Frank has always made it an effort after the first game that we've won at the beat baseball World Series to come over and give me a hug, because it's a brotherly thing.
Yeah.
However, we did have our fair share of competitions where from 7th grade or 12 years old and on, Frank and I competed and participated on the wrestling team in the Freeport school systems, in the junior high school and then on to high school. So there were times that he and I had to wrestle against each other because, again, being twins, we – hold on just 1 second, Phil.
All right.
We had similar weights, so we had to wrestle each other off as to who's going to wrestle in the match the next day. So Frank wrestled at 145 pounds, I wrestled at 138 pounds, we had to decide where we had to wrestle off at some point.
Uh-huh.
Even though I was at a lower weight, I may have wrestled up that day onto a heavier weight class. But we had our fair share of competitions, and I have to admit, I probably excelled at those competitions. You know, I probably succeeded more, but, you know, it was a competition. It was, you know, it was not a competition I wanted to have, but according to the coach, we had to have it.
Yeah,
you know, we had to see who's gonna be. You know, it's survival of the fittest. But Frank, in his own sense, is just an athlete. Frank was a great wrestler, and he plays beat baseball great. And we have a lot of fun together. It's I'm glad we're on the same team now, as opposed to competing against each other, because I'm sure the competition would be fierce.
When you finished high school, both of you, what did you either one of you, especially you, since we're interviewing you, what did you have in mind that you thought you might be able to do to support yourself or to become an adult?
I'll say this, that I always wanted to become an attorney. However, as I went on in college, I realized that it was not my cup of tea. It was going to require a lot more schooling. However, when I was about 15 years old, we had an unfortunate, tragic situation in my family, and my father passed away. And it was my mom, my brother, and I. So we were always on the understanding that with four people in the family, my father, mother, myself, and my brother Frank, we're four wheels of a car.
Uh-huh.
So now, without my father being there, we had to team up as a team of three and succeed. So at the age of 15, my brother went off to get a job in a deli, and for obvious reasons, and it's not very often that you see or hear of a blind person who's working in a deli with the cutting machine and everything like that. So I had to create my own job opportunity. So I realized in the Freeport area, we were in the local library. We were having a multi-million-dollar expansion going on. So I went into the library director at that point, Jerry Nichols, and who's now retired at this point. And he, as a director of the Freeport Library, I pitched him the idea that, hey, you know, why don't you have Braille books or books of large print and such that are available for any patron who's blind or visually impaired to come in and pick off the shelves?
Uh-huh.
How come someone sighted can come in and pick a book off the shelves and check it out and take it out, but a blind person can't? So in pitching that idea, I pitched a Braille library, and I got materials from the local area places such as Helen Keller Services and other places that had, discarded Braille books.
Uh-huh.
And I created my job there from the age of 15, which was in 1985 through 1991. So it gave me a sense of workability, at least through graduating high school and into the beginning of college. And when I went to college, I went to Hofstra University, which is here also on Long Island. I got a job with them working in their service desk or information desk. And that then transpired into during the summers when most of the dorms were empty of students, they ran a conference program, meaning that all the empty dorms and beds that they had, they would then convert and make available for conferences to come in and stay cheap mm-hmm. On the college campus, and they wouldn't be killed by the enormous bills of a hotel. Mm-hmm. They would be given a fraction of what the situation is. The bed costs were considerably cheaper, but they had to give a little bit more. You had in like a college dormitory, you have situations that you have floor bathrooms with showers. Mm-hmm. It's not private bathrooms. So that was a trade-off that a lot of these conference attendees had to contend with. But from the time of 1988, summer of 1988 through when I graduated in 1993, I had a summer job. And that summer job actually transpired into being a year-round job. So I was in a continuous work-study program that, for the most part, helped me get through school and pay mm-hmm. my way through school.
Okay, what did you study in college? What were your major and minor?
No specific major and minor. I graduated with a Bachelor's of Fine Arts. It's a concentration of political science, history, and speech. More U.S. American history and such. Speech arts and speech, like I know how to talk. Speech arts.
Okay.
Where I did public speaking.
Yeah.
And I learned the arts of public speaking and such. Political science, because I still, again, going back to the onset, I had the belief that I wanted to become a lawyer. As I went through college and I put myself through college, I said, I can't stand being in college for another 3 years. I just couldn't. At that time, I saw the people who were becoming lawyers, and I saw the work they had to do. Of course, the work didn't scare me, but it was the quality of the person. Lawyers are a dime a dozen. Not to fault anyone who's a lawyer, they're a dime a dozen. I mean, could I have excelled at it as an attorney? Yeah, probably so, but I wasn't happy doing that. I was just becoming involved with computers. And that was what was interesting to me, and that's what I found interesting.
Well, and you may suffer from this, you may not. Until I'm married to an attorney, and until I again observed her or talked with her or met her, which was 20-something years ago, I had a misconception of what lawyers did. What lawyers do is a lot of BS. They talk they talk to a lot of people who don't really know what they think. I want to sue him. Well, hell, you can't just sue anybody you want to for anything, regardless of what you think. They're most of the people she talks to are people who really don't have any business.
Yeah.
You see Perry Mason and you think, well, that's what lawyers do. Well, it isn't. So you may have been disappointed. And like you said, they're a dime a dozen. There's lots of
them. Right. And I have some dear friends that are judges who were previously attorneys. And you're right. You have to have – I have a respect for what they do. And I can tell you there are several individuals who I know who are blind who are attorneys. And, it takes a tremendous effort on a daily basis for any of us, whether it be for you or whether it be for myself or anyone else that listens to this Blind Like Me show or is on the list. For us to be par with the sighted world, it takes 250% to a 50% ratio of a sighted person. I mean, how many people do I know that I see come in to work on a daily basis? They come in at 9:05 where they're going to start work at 9:00. I'm there at 8:00 because I know what I need to do to get my day started. If I start at 9:00, then I'm usually there by 8:00. But that's just my work ethic, and doesn't mean that everyone's work ethic should be the same. But for me to be par with sighted people around me, I need to work twice as hard.
Well, you have to be you have to be 150% if you're going to compete in a sighted world. Because, first of all, 90% of the sighted people you meet think you can't do it in the first place. They assume
exactly.
You're blind, you can't do a damn thing. You're lucky to be able to feed yourself.
Or they're not sure.
Yeah. You're lucky to be able to feed yourself and tie your shoe as a blind person. Whereas we know. And so you got this degree. What did you think you could do with that degree? Teach or what?
I knew I didn't want to teach. I mean, it's just when I graduated college in 1993, I was about 24 years old. I really didn't know what the hell I wanted to do. I knew I was good speaking. I knew I was good. And what stuff I knew from in terms of computers and such like that, I knew I could get by, and I knew I had a career eventually in whatever an opportunity came to me, I can make it work. So in 1994, I applied with an organization here in New York called Just One Break. It's an organization that finds jobs, so it is a job recruiting agency for those individuals who are disabled, whether they be physical or social or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
They found jobs, and I took on a job after I was an applicant of theirs as a recruiter. Now, as a recruiter, you're not only working on commission, but you're also working for placements. So it's very difficult in trying to find someone a job that they may have all the qualifications. However, they may just not interview well.
Yeah.
So you have to try to coach them and train them and such like that. And I knew probably halfway through the time that I was there, and I was only there for about 8 months, it was not a good exact fit for me. It was not a fit that – it's something I could do. I could look at it, and as so many people have said so many times before, it's a job.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a job, of course. But I mean, at the time, I was commuting to and from Long Island into the city every day. It was putting on a lot of stress on me because I was traveling with a guide dog. And mind you, I want to go back just on tangents to tell you that I used a cane until 1987. I was given a cane at the age of 7. And started working with a cane then, and then at the age of 18, I went for my first guide dog. So now, imagine the stress of going to and from New York City every day with a guide dog. You're dealing with not only the weather elements, but also the traveling to and from, and where if I want to get into a cab, the ever so popular idea of a cab driver saying, no, I can't take a guide dog, that was very real in 1994, and still is today. But so you're traveling to and from, realizing now about November or so of 1994, I left Just One Break, and I got an opportunity of a customer service position working with computers in a credit card company. At that point, it was First Chicago. First Card Services, which then went into First USA and then Bank One, and now it's Chase. But I was there only until about 2000. So going
now, what did you do for them? What were you in customer relations or what?
In customer service, people call up and saying, "Hey, I have a problem with my credit card statement, or I have a problem. Can you explain this late fee to me?" And I did that. It was over the phone. It was computers. We were using job access with speech or JAWS with a mainframe emulation, so we could work on it on the mainframe or the computer system there.
But you dealt with the public day to day on the phone.
Day to day,
and
that was kind of grueling at first because it really gave me the opportunity to hone in and sharpen my skills on speaking, my computer work, and also how to handle and problem resolve, you know, and problem solve. And, I'm a glutton for punishment. Someone says to me, "Hey, we have overtime. Do you want to work overtime?" "Sure. What time do you want me to come in?" So I was working the night shift from 4 till 12:30 every night. And they say, "Oh, you want to come in for overtime? Come in at 12 o'clock. Okay. Give me 12 o'clock. So, I mean, I was literally on the phones outside the an hour and a half of a break the rest of the time. So
and being paid well for it.
No, Phil, you know as well as I do, you go to work for a bank, you don't get paid well.
No, you're right.
It's a joke.
Yeah.
But it's I did well, and I earned a lot of money because I worked the overtime. My idea was, at the time, being 26 years old, 25, 26 years old, I said, I don't have a family. I'm not married. I don't have kids. I says, I can go work all the overtime now and take it away from the opportunity of the people who do have a family when it comes time for the holidays.
Make that money.
Let them go spend time with their families.
Make that money. Yes, sir. I got you.
Exactly. And I was lucky enough in 1996 that at the time I was not dating someone to score a opportunity of buying my own home here on Long Island. That's where I'm speaking to you from now.
Yeah,
it's directly around the corner from where I grew up. It was a it's a gold mine because the ideal thing is what, and I don't know about other people, but my idea is this: I want to be as independent as I can be.
Yes, sir.
I want to try to do as much as I possibly can and not rely on people if I don't have to. So ideally, the ideal place for me to live would be someplace where I can walk to everything. Well, lo and behold, I am in the area where I can walk to everything. Huh. If I walk north of my house, I can go up to where the post office is, the library, the supermarket, or the food store. If I go south, I can go to any number one of convenience stores, a dry cleaner, or a hardware store,
yes, sir.
A butcher. You know, because that's where I buy all my meat from, is a butcher. But it's so it was ideal. It was I lived in the it's legal two family house. It has an apartment upstairs. I lived in the apartment upstairs for about a year, and then they said, "Well, we're going to be selling the house." So I said, "This is a golden opportunity." I go, "They can come and show people all they want the house." I said, "But I want to wait." And I made them a deal that once the real estate contract was up, I would make him an offer that day that the contract was up.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I made them a better offer in return on their house than what the real estate was going to give them.
And you bought it.
Bought it.
Good.
It's a three-story house, has 10,000 square feet. It's 75 by 125. And I know that's just a pebble stone throw for you guys in Texas, right?
Yo, my house, I don't have near that much room.
Well, It's a wonderful house. It's an old house. It was built in 1910.
Are you moved downstairs now, though, right?
I moved downstairs from upstairs.
And rent out the apartment?
I'm sorry?
Do you rent out the apartment?
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. I won't disclose how much I'm renting for, but it's even with the economic requirements of real estate rentals in the state of New York.
Are you rent controlled? Is all the state of New York rent controlled?
No, that's only in the five boroughs of New York City. And in case you don't know that, Phil, the five boroughs are Manhattan, Bronx, Staten Island, Brooklyn, and Queens.
Those are the five boroughs. I did know that. I've been to New York a couple times.
Good. The next time you come to New York, you're going to have to give me a ring.
Well, I will. We spent a week in New York, walked everywhere, rode the subway, went out to Staten Island. We did the New York thing. We went to a play. We spent some time in New York. All right. So in 2000, you changed jobs and you went where? What did you do then?
I left. I left them what was First USA. They indicated to us that they're going to be closing the building for efficiency reasons, cost-effective reasons. And I was given the opportunity of looking for a job while still was employed. And, I got severance.
Yeah.
So I found a job and started 12 days after the last day I was at First USA, working for ADECO North America, which is the largest temporary staffing and full-time staffing agency in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And I want to go back in tangent and tell you this. About 1998, I moved over from customer service to IT. A lovely friend who's a part of the Long Island Bombers, her name is Susan Bertrand, she talked to me about transitioning over from customer service to IT.
What is IT?
IT is information technology.
Okay.
The help desk people.
Okay.
Or, moving over from customer service to their IT or their help desk area, that would just be working with everybody in that building. So I said, yeah. So, I mean, I learned from the ground up Microsoft Access, and I knew some Microsoft Access previously, but I was fully using the Microsoft Access database program, and I was supporting everything from soup to nuts. Give you a staggering statistic that I still remember from then was the month prior to me coming on, the people or the technicians who were being assigned tickets, work tickets, to go out and resolve problems, they were entering only 80 tickets a month. The month that I came in the first 3 months, concurrently, we handled and registered between 350 and 450 tickets per month.
And why the increase? Why? What was the
because increase? they had a person, namely myself, who was able to sit at a desk and work on a computer without getting eye fatigue. So they always had someone able to go enter in tickets and assign them. So previously, the guys who were technicians were sighted.
Yeah.
And they found it, I would rather go stand outside by the window and look out the window than come back and enter a ticket. So that's why there was such an increase.
And so, that was mainly due to you.
Exactly.
That's pretty,
and
pretty neat.
I learned. The gentleman that ran that department is a dear friend. His name is Rob Masilla. He taught me everything I needed to know and still utilize today in terms of information technology and how to how to resolve issues and technical issues and how to look for things and the whole soup and nuts of it. It's he was a great boss and is a great friend. And between him and Susan Bertrand, without them giving me the opportunity, now I have to tell you, Rob didn't like me because I was a hound on him as to, hey, when will we get the new version of JAWS? When will we get the newest version? You know, the newest version is now. We don't have it yet. You know, and I was a pain in his neck. You know, but
or in somewhere. A pain somewhere.
Yeah,
now, do you still work for these folks?
No. Actually, when I went to ADECO staffing, I transitioned and applied with them as a an analyst on their help desk, a fully integrated help desk. I mean, it was we covered over 10,000 machines and over 5,000 employees. And
but you left this job in 2000.
We left first. I left First USA in 2000, and I moved over to ADECO staffing in June of 2000. And that's where it was the fully integrated help desk.
Okay.
And then that's where I was servicing customers from all different local offices in different areas of the United States and Canada for about 4 years.
Helping them solve their computer problems.
Anything you can think of. Installing a printer, fixing their email, configuring their email.
Yeah, that's great.
Explaining to them why they get that blue screen of death. You know, there's a whole bunch of things. But I did that from June of 2000 through December of 2004.
All right, where'd you go then?
Then I left there because I was not getting the growth opportunity that I expected I was going to get. They would not allow me to go beyond the first level analyst. And though I enjoyed it and though I gained from it, I just was not gaining from it anymore.
Okay.
So I left there, took some time off, and I. A friend of mine, her name is Sheila Amato. She's a teacher of the visually impaired and is very instrumental in a lot of the things that I did between 1999 and 2004 in terms of learning how to give seminars on assistive technology or access technology. And I'll get into that in a second. But she told me about a job opportunity with the company that you know of being Independent Living Aids.
Yeah.
And they were looking for a person as an assistive technology specialist. And I interviewed with Mimi Sandler, who's the vice president of Independent Living Aids, and her husband, Marvin Sandler.
Uh-huh.
I interviewed with them on a Tuesday. And they called me within a week and said, when could I start?
Yeah.
So I started about a week later, and I've been there ever since. And I've been seeing that company grow in so many different ways, and they were so receptive, and they're still very, very receptive to the ideas that I bring to the table because not only am I totally blind, but I have my background of my normal working with sighted people help desk.
Yeah.
Situation and helping sighted people fix their computers. I bring that IT experience to them, but I also bring all my know-how of being a cane traveler. being a guide dog user, being a person who's used assistive technology. You know, and that's a big, big plus to them, because they'll, someone from customer service can call me and say, I have a person on the phone that stands 5'6", and they want to know how long of a cane should they order. And then I simply ask them, because I wrote an article that is published on the internet on choosing your cane. And because there's two conventional theories of choosing a cane, either those who are mobility instructors would teach you to measure your cane up to your sternum or your solar plexus.
Not up the end of your nose.
Or the NFB style, which is up to the end of your nose. Now, I ask people generally, no matter what they're going to use, no matter what cane they're going to choose, as to how fast do you walk? Because my idea and what I've noticed over years, and I'm a cane user for the last year because I just retired my third guide dog, but I was always a cane user even with a guide dog, because there's sometimes in some places that are just not acceptable or just not appropriate to bring you
for guide dogs. Yeah.
So when I ask people if they are fast, slow, or medium walkers and such like that, I usually will say, if you're a medium to fast walker, you should add on at least an inch or another 2 inches, so you can have that opportunity
to stop.
Yeah. If you hit a crack in the sidewalk and you have your hand at the top of the handle, and by some chance you're going to choke up and that cane's going to get jammed. So if you can feel 2 inches more, you can stop 2 seconds quicker.
Yeah.
And you're not going to necessarily break your cane. You know, I can't begin to tell you how many conventions I've been to in the last 2.5 years with independent living aids. The people come up running up to our booth and said, "Do you have a cane I can buy? My cane just broke." So, I mean, it's a realism. There are so many people out there using canes, yeah. And they have that problem.
Now, these people have their physical office. They're in New York?
Independent Living Aids is located in Jericho, New York. It's here on Long Island. It's about a half an hour, 45 minutes ride with a paratransit service or accessor ride, if you will.
And that's what you do now. That's where you work now.
That's where I go now every day, Monday through Friday.
All right. You know, it's obvious that you are passionate about many things, but we're getting down, not to the end, but close enough where we need to talk about your real passion, and that is Beep Baseball.
Absolutely. There's so many different things, Phil. I can first tell you that when I first got introduced to Beep Baseball, I spoke of a gentleman by the name of James Hughes. He and I went to the sleepaway camp back in the 80s, and I found out he was living here on Long Island. And I said, "That's fantastic." I go, let me try to contact him. So he and I were talking, we're catching up. I go, "Jim, what do you do for recreation?" He goes, "I play beat baseball." I go, "You play beat baseball with who?" Because I played with a team by the name of Out of Sight back in 1988 through 91.
Uh-huh.
And that was only recreation. I mean, I didn't think nothing of it competing on a world or United States level or national level, for that matter. So he was part of a team. James was part of a team in here on Long Island called the Babylon Beepers. I went and played with him for 2 years. And I said, this is recreational. They're never going to travel. I was trying to plant the seed. Well, maybe we should think about doing more competitive beat baseball. No, we'll stay here in Long Island. We'll do all the charity games, blah, 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 which is all fine and good. But I was hungry. So going back when I was about 8 years old, Industrial Home for the Blind, again, now Helen Keller Services, they had a dance here on Long Island, and they invited all the blind people from Industrial Home for the Blind to a basement of a bank where they had a dance for blind people. It was a blind dance.
Yeah.
And the guy who was spinning the records as a DJ was also blind. And him and his wife did the whole night, playing the music all 9 yards. His name is Ted Fast. One of the most dynamic people you'll ever have the chance to meet. And by all means, I'm certainly going to put you in contact with him, because I think he's certainly a person you probably could have on your show here too. Because
he's
a great person overall. But
yeah.
So I met him when I was 8. So, I don't know, it's 1997. I had thought about starting the Long Island Bombers, and at the time we didn't have a name for it or whatever case it may be. And we're driving down a local highway here called Sunrise Highway. It runs all the way from the city all the way out to Montauk, which is the eastern point of Long Island.
Uh-huh.
And my mother says, "You know, remember that guy Ted Fast? And he's he has a storefront here in this town where we're going through. So she says, you know, I'm going to try to slow down and see what the phone number is on in the window of the store. So I called him. I went over and to talk to him. He remembered who I was, and we got to talking and everything like that. And I said to him, I go, tell him, let me ask you something. Do you like baseball? He goes, I love baseball. And we're both Yankee fans.
Sure.
And we're cringing because we're hoping tonight they don't get swept by the Indians. But anyway, the Cleveland and the Indians.
not that we
don't want to see Cleveland win, but still, we don't want them to beat us.
I understand. I understand.
So
that's how you got in beat baseball.
Not specifically. I invited Ted down to see a charity game between the Babylon Beavers and the Long Island Islanders, the local professional hockey team. And he loved it. He loved the sport. He loved the concept of doing charity games on 9 yards. So I built with him, starting in 1997, a beat baseball team that would play competitively. And we then started building. I then was able to steal James Hughes away from the Babylon Beavers, and he came over to the Long Island Bombers. And we started building the team where we are now, where we're playing on a national competitive level. We go every year to the World Series. And the thrill that I love about beat baseball is this. It gives an individual, no matter if they have low vision or no vision, the opportunity, if they're a baseball enthusiast, to go out, not only hit a pitch ball, run unwaveringly and without any hesitation, full tilt to a base that's 100 feet away, or even for that matter, to put on a glove if they use a glove, dive across the field and catch the ball in the glove. Like they're just a regular baseball player.
Okay, let's slow down here just a little bit. I know very little about beat baseball, so I'm going to ask you some questions that are academic that I should know the answer to. Now,
sure.
the principle of beat baseball, this is a ball with a bell in it, and the ball is pitched to you. You hear the bell or the ball coming, and you hit it. What kind of bat?
Let's go back.
Okay.
Let's go to the fundamentals.
Okay.
Beat baseball is just that. The ball beeps and the bases buzz.
Okay.
Where the ball emits a rapid beep.
Okay.
And the bases have a straight, flat line tone that you can hear, which you're able then to differentiate between the ball and the base.
Yes.
So, yes, the ball does get pitched. The pitcher and catcher are on your own team. That's in order for you to maximize the opportunity of hitting the ball. Where in regular baseball,
I understand,
the pitcher and catcher are on the opposite team.
Yep.
So you want to try to strike everybody out.
Yeah.
But in beat baseball, you have your own pitcher, and he stands 20 feet from the front of home plate. And the idea for the catcher and pitcher as a unit, as a team, is to pitch and set a target, have the catcher set up a target where the pitcher can see that target, pitch straight to that target, and then the batter then swings in that area where the ball's being pitched, and they try to make contact.
Okay, the pitcher can see.
Yes, so can the catcher.
The pitcher and catcher can both see, but
right.
You can't.
That's correct.
If you have partial sight, they blindfold you. Is that right?
No, everyone's blindfolded, so the field of play is level.
Okay, but the pitcher and catcher can see, and they're members of your team.
Right.
They're your guys.
That's right.
Okay, so the ball 20 feet, it's pitched to you, you hear it, you hit it with what sort of bat? A regular metal bat?
It's an aluminum regulation softball bat.
Okay.
And they can range as the bats used today range from the weight of 30 ounces up to 38 ounces and cannot exceed 34 inches long.
Okay, so you hit the ball. You've hit the ball, and then you run to a base before someone from the opposite team catches the ball. Correct?
Right, and there's correct. And I want to go off on tangent and tell you, in baseball you have three bases.
Yes.
In beat baseball, you have bases only fixed down the first and third base line.
Okay. On the corner.
There's no point to putting second base because you'll run over everybody.
You'll hit the guys who are trying to catch the ball.
Exactly. And you don't want to do that.
No,
you want to try to prevent as many injuries as possible.
So yeah.
At the point of contact, when the batter hits the ball, someone, as in an official status, known as a base operator, switches on a box. And the box has one switch. It either goes left or right. Left meaning third, right meaning first. So they determine at the point of contact what base you're running to. You don't know what base you're running to.
Okay. Do they have to be at the base to do it, or can it be done by Bluetooth or by remote
It's done by wire remote. The person actually, the base operator sits behind home plate, and the bases are hardwired down the first and third base line.
I got you. And so he turns on the base that you're going to run to.
That's correct.
But is that arbitrary on his part or her part?
Yes.
So
it can be directed by the umpire pointing.
Okay.
The umpire can sit there, in most situations, will point as to what base to turn on. But the batter, who's blindfolded, doesn't know.
Until he hears the buzz.
Exactly.
And so you run to that base. Do you stay on that base, or what do you do?
If you get to the base before the defense fields the ball, it's a run.
And if they catch the ball, they turn the base off.
Well, for a matter of safety, no. If the defense fields the ball and shows clean position of the ball to the umpire will say out. Now, at that point, what we've come to see and understand is you don't ever want to shut the base off until the umpire rules what it's going to be, whether it be safe or out.
Uh-huh.
Because the defense couldn't very well drop the ball, and if the base gets shut off, there's a malfunction there. Because the batter could have scored if the base was left on.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. How do you score? You score by reaching the base?
Reaching the base prior to the defense fielding the ball.
Okay.
And you're awarded a run.
Your team is awarded a run.
Right.
Okay.
And there are three outs in an inning. There are six innings of play, unless there's a tie, of course, and you play extra innings until there's a determined winner.
So there are a good number of sighted people involved in this game.
Well, let's go back and let's talk about the defense for a quick second.
Okay.
On the defense, there are a couple different conventional ways of doing defense. Some defense will set up, and there is one or two people who are sighted on the field, because they are known as field spotters. At the point of contact, the field spotter will call out a zone number on any field of play in defense for no matter what team it is. The team will then zone off across the field 1 through 6 numbers. So the idea there is when the ball is hit, the field spotter will call out that zone, and then the players move to that zone to try to field the ball.
Zone 3.
They can only say 3, 2, 1, or whatever the number is, but that's all they can say. They can't say anything else.
How is the field zoned? Real quick, because we're almost out of time.
Deep right field is usually 1, according to my team's configuration. Short right field, which is just inside first base, is 2.
Uh-huh.
Straight up the middle is 3.
Okay.
Shortstop is 4.
Okay.
Third base is 5, and deep center field is 6.
And that's always that way. That never
pretty
changes.
Much. I mean, some teams do it differently, but that's right. Generally the configuration.
Okay, now you're coming to the World Series of Baseball is in Houston next summer, right?
That's right. We were there in 2005 as well.
Well, we'll get to shake your hand because I think we're going to come down and do some recording to run on one of these shows, probably on Blind Like Me.
Okay.
I plan to do that. Listen, if somebody's interested in baseball, give us a website where they can get in touch with you and find out more about it.
Okay, if they want to get involved and learn more about Beat Baseball as I'm being the secretary of the National Beat Baseball Association, they can go to www.nbba.org. That's Nancy Boy Boy Alpha. Or if you want to ever listen to about people in the sport of Beat Baseball, since I'm the Beat Baseball guy,
yes,
you can go to my website at www.beatbaseball.org.
Okay, do you have podcasts of games there?
We have 13 podcasts right there, up there now. And the most recent podcast we have is the championship game between the Kansas All-Stars and the West Coast Dogs that was recorded by me on August 4th in the torrential rain and downpour.
Right.
But it was great quality. And Kevin Simpson and Wayne Simpson, who co-hosted the show with me, did the play-by-play and color commentary. So
Stephen Guerra, we are absolutely out of time. We've killed an hour. You always look for a guy who'll answer questions, and by God, you did.
I'd love to come back on so I can share more with you, because I love talking to you.
We'll do that, and I'll plan on seeing you next summer, sir. Hang on just a second, okay?
Sure.
Let me get everything stopped. We'll be right back. that gentleman had no problem answering questions and talking, did he, huh? What a good guest. Stephen Guerra, Pete Baseball. Go to his website and look at what he's got there. I think guy did some announcements for him, some little drops that he's using. So go listen to some podcasts of Big Baseball, and you might get interested yourself. One thing we failed to mention, somebody pointed out the other day, and that is our two lists that we have. We have a Blind Like Me list, and to subscribe to that list, you go to send a message to blindlikeme-subscribe. blindlikeme-subscribe at yahoogroups.com. blindlikeme-subscribe at yahoogroups.com. You'll get a message back confirming your subscription, and you'll be on the list with about 200 of us who talk about nothing, really. We just talk. We just visit. There is also a Blind Handyman list that can be accessed the same way. blindhandyman-subscribe at yahoogroups.com. blindhandyman-subscribe at yahoogroups.com. That'll get you on the Blind Handyman list if you're a Blind Handyman person. You're going to find somebody on there who's done everything you want to do. If you want a roof, if you want a floor, whatever you want to do, somebody's done it, and we'll have some good suggestions on how to do whatever Blind Handyman project you want to do, and we encourage everybody to go be on that list. Now, sometimes they're high traffic, sometimes they're not, so just take your chances, but we'd love to have you on either list. If you'd like to be a guest, you can contact me, Phil Parr, P-H-I-L-P-A-R-R, at Consolidated, C-O-N-S-O-L-I-D-A-T-E-D, .net. Phil Parr at Consolidated.net. Or if you want to call me, the best way is to email me, please. But if you'd like to call and chat on the phone, you can do that. 936-634-9500 is my phone number. Thank you for listening. We always need guests, and we need you as a guest. Come and join with us. Thank you much for listening. We'll do it again next week. I'm Phil Parr. Bye-bye.